dangerous because it allows people to speak for themselves. Which reminds me of a moment at the Democratic Convention this year. We covered the Republican Convention and followed the money and went to the Democratic Convention in Charlotte, this city rich with civil rights history. You know, the Greensboro sit-ins in 1960, the young people who went to integrate the lunch counters at Woolworths, inspired the students at the historically black college, Johnson C. Smith College in Charlotte. They did the same in Charlotte. Well, on the first day of the Democratic Convention, I got a text. We were about to go inside. They were going to gavel it open. But I get this text, and it says that on a particular corner, an action was going to take place. So we raced over to the corner, and we see the UNDOCU bus pull up. That's the bus covered with butterflies, filled with undocumented immigrants who were challenging the Democratic Party to pass a compassionate, fair, rational immigration policy in this country. And, you know, and they were inspired by the young dreamers, young people who are sitting in on President Obama's campaign offices and other senators and Congress members' offices. And these young people risk more than arrest for their civil disobedience. They risk deportation, sometimes to countries they don't even know. Maybe they came here when they were 6 months old or a year old. They might not even have known they were undocumented until they're older and they apply for a driver's license, or perhaps they don't even know. They think they're just a supporter sitting down, but in fact they themselves are undocumented. But they sat in these offices, and this wasn't lost on President Obama. I mean, that this is the modern-day civil rights movement. And I think it shamed him, because this summer he conceded and he passed he issued a kind of executive order that said that undocumented immigrants 30 years or younger who fit a certain criteria could get deferred action, could get a reprieve from the threat of deportation for 2 years so that they could work here, so they could go to school here. Okay, they couldn't get health insurance, but they could get these other things. This inspired this new group to come to Charlotte. It was the young dreamers and their parents now. And they pulled up in front of the convention, and they got out real quickly. And they were very energetic, and they were chanting, "No papers, no fear, no papers, no fear." And I was interviewing one of the leaders, Rosie Carrasco. I recognized her because we had her on the show that morning. It's often interesting to watch Democracy Now! And see who's on and what they do. So Rosie Carrasco got out of the bus, and I was asking her why she was doing this. And a media personality came up to me, well-known. It's hard to call them journalists. But so he came up to me. He was on his way into the network. You know, he was going to the convention. And he said, "What are these people doing?" And I said, "Oh, it looks like they're about to get arrested." And he said, "What do they want? What are they calling for?" Now, I am interviewing Rosie. And so I say to him, "Well, why don't you ask her?" And he said, "No, Amy, just tell me." I'd been on panels with him. "Just quickly summarize. What is it that she wants?" And I said, "Rosie, why don't you tell this gentleman what it is you want?" And she said, "I want to know what kind of legacy President Obama wants to leave. I want to know if he wants to be remembered as the president who deported more immigrants than any other in U.S. history, or who sided with the immigrants." Pretty eloquent. And he actually took out his reporter's notebook and started taking notes. Why is it so difficult for them to talk to people at the heart of the story, who are at the target end of policy? And her husband came out of the bus, and he said, "I've paid taxes in this country for 18 years, which is more than Citibank can say." And so Rosie and her husband, Martin and Zweta, and their daughter, they were going to get arrested. And then there was this young woman who had her arm wrapped around an older, shorter woman. She would not let go of her. She came out of the bus. They marched down the street. They went to the gates of the convention. They all unfurled this big banner with a big butterfly on it. And she and her mother sat down. And I said to this young woman, "You know, you kind of look like you probably would fit into this new criterion that could get you deferred action and you could stay in this country." And she said, "I can, but my mother can't. And if she gets deported, I might as well go with her." And then there was another young woman kneeling down. You know, the rain was pouring down and the police were pouring in. And I asked her, why the butterflies? Why these butterflies on the Undocubus? Why this big butterfly on this banner? And she said, because butterflies know no borders. Butterflies are free. And with that, 9 or 10 of the young people and their families got arrested. These are the movements that make this country great. And I want to talk about movements. You know, it's so much what we focus on at Democracy Now! Let's go back to December 2010, the uprising in Tunisia, sparked by a young man named Mohamed Bouazizi, who comes out of university, has no opportunity, so he goes into the market to sell fruit and vegetables, and the authorities are harassing him. They steal a scale. He can't take it anymore, and he sets himself on fire. And that ignites the frustration of a generation, of a nation. And I think there was also something else that sparked the Tunisian Revolution, and that was WikiLeaks, the whistleblower website. We can't say enough about how important this website is in a time when governments are cracking down on information, in a time especially of war, when we need transparency more than ever, how important it is to see these documents that have been released by WikiLeaks. I mean, there's a reason why all the top news organizations, the New York Times and the Washington Post and El País and the Guardian, all these top newspapers, Der Spiegel, around the world work with WikiLeaks because they felt they were important too. Julian Assange, the founder of WikiLeaks, is in a lot of trouble. Right. He is holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. He's been granted political asylum by Ecuador. He's wanted for questioning in Sweden for two women who say he sexually abused them. And that's serious, and that should be dealt with. But what the media gets wrong is they say he's been charged. He hasn't. And even if you're charged, you have to go to trial. That doesn't mean you are guilty. But whatever the evidence is, it hasn't even risen to the level of charges being brought against him. He is wanted for questioning. It's something he says he will do, and the Ecuadorian government has backed him up and reached out to Sweden, said, how can he answer your questions? He will do that. But what he's concerned about is if he is extradited to Sweden, it's not being in Sweden. He said he would do that. He wants a promise for the U.S. government that they will not then extradite him to the United States. Because we know that there was a secret grand jury impaneled in Alexandria, Virginia, that's been going after Julian Assange and other WikiLeaks volunteers. And the question is, has there already been a secret indictment that has a sealed indictment against Julian Assange for treason in this country? And why should he be afraid if he were extradited to this country? Does the name Bradley Manning ring a bell? When you think about what has happened to this young man, this U.S. soldier who was in Iraq, who has been charged with apparently, I mean, it's amazing to think he could be in the desert in Iraq and he could bring in CDs that he labeled Lady Gaga and download millions of pages of top U.S. government, secret government documents on Iraq, on Afghanistan, secret State Department cables. And why are these documents so important? Well, I think if known, they could save lives. Let's use one example. February 2007 in Iraq. And this is why this is so important. You know, this all isn't about Julian Assange. If he wrote the documents, it would be, and we should know all about him. But no one refutes, no one contests the authenticity of these documents, written by low-level soldiers and officers, written by State Department officials, ambassadors, in the case of State Department documents. So the ones in Iraq, February 2007, this incident where an Apache helicopter unit is hovering over two men who Iraqis who put up their hands in a surrender sign. And the soldiers in the helicopter aren't rogue. They call back to base and they say, what should we do? These Iraqis look like they're surrendering to us. And the lawyer on the base says to them, this is according to the documents, the military documents that were released, says to them, you cannot surrender to a helicopter. And so they blow them away. And you gasp. And I think people all over would gasp. And I think if we knew that at the time, that there would have been an investigation. You know, there would have been an outcry, an investigation. And so what happened 6 months later may not have happened. And that was July 12th, 2007. It was in an area of Baghdad called New Baghdad. The same Apache helicopter unit is hovering overhead. And below they see, and this is video released by WikiLeaks that WikiLeaks called collateral murder. This isn't video of Iraqis on the ground or peace activists. This is the video made by the Apache helicopter unit. And it is filled with the soldiers laughing and cursing. They call back to base again. You know, they're not out of line. They are always calling back for permission. And they're calling back for permission to open fire on what they see below, which is a group of men who are actually touring around two Reuters employees, an up-and-coming videographer named Namir Nur Eldin. I think he was about 22 years old. And his driver, Saeed Chima. And they were there because the area had just been bombed the day before, and they were being shown around. His driver, Saeed Chima. But, you know, drivers in wartime are not just drivers. He was beloved by the Reuters community. He's 40 years old, a father of four. Because when Western journalists helicopter in, parachute in somewhere for a week, they need to get a lay of the land fast. And it's these drivers or fixers who are telling them what the area is about, who the people are, bringing them. They're really like reporters themselves. And so Saeed and Shema are walking through this area. The helicopter unit above calls back to base, asks for permission to open fire, and they open fire on this group of residents below with the journalist and his driver. And they kill almost all of them. Saeed Shema is critically wounded. He's dragging himself away, and a white van pulls up from the neighborhood to help the wounded. It's got two little kids in it. It's got others in it, and the helicopter unit opens fire and blows away the van. Actually, the two children survive, though they're critically wounded, and Saeed Chima is killed. 12 people were killed and all that day. And I dare say, if we knew what happened in February, Namir, Saeed, they'd be alive today. That's why information is so important. And it can save lives. That's why WikiLeaks, I think, is so important. So how does that relate to Tunisia? Well, you know, the State Department documents that came out showed that, you know, Ben Ali, the dictator of Tunisia, was corrupt and he was brutal. It's not like the Tunisians didn't know that already. But what they saw in the documents was that the U.S. government knew it, and yet they continued to shore him up to the tune of millions of dollars every year, and it just increased their rage. And then the Tunisian Revolution fueled the Egyptian Revolution. And how many of you experienced the Egyptian Revolution, at least partly by the remarkable reporting of Democracy Now! Producer Sharif Abdelkaddous? Sharif is... Sharif is Egyptian-American, the son of an illustrious Egyptian family. His father, his grandfather, is the most famous writer of Egypt, Hassan Abdelkaddous. And Sharif started getting texts in January of 2011. It's saying, it was his friends, it was family, it was people saying, I'm going to die for my country. He said, no, these are not political people. You know, what is happening in my country? He said, it's changing. And he flew directly into Tahrir, okay, by way of the Cairo airport. But he hardly left for the next 18 days. And, you know, when he got there, Mubarak had plunged the country into digital darkness. turned off the internet. Well, Mubarak couldn't do that, but he used a U.S. company, California company, Naras, to turn off the internet. And there was such an outcry when they flipped the switch that they issued a press release saying, we were only following orders, but we've heard that before. So, but Sharif got around the digital blockade, and he became one of the top tweeters in the world. You know, from the beginning, Democracy Now! Has always been very scrappy, relied on the internet from the beginning to be able to transmit our broadcast quality radio. At the time, it wasn't even a podcast. That word wasn't around then. But the MP3 so that radio stations could take it. And then when we went on television, September 2001, and we were sending out those video cassettes, we pioneered a way to send broadcast quality video through the internet. And necessity is the mother of invention. We weren't able quite to use, we couldn't afford to use the satellites, and we use them sometimes now. But when the internet went back up, the thugs took down the satellites for the major networks, broke into the U.S. news offices and the international TV offices and broke down the satellites. And so I remember seeing Anderson Cooper in his hotel room in a sort of old Democracy Now! Sort of very fuzzy, Skype-y look with a lower third that said, reporting from an undisclosed location. And there was Sharif in the middle of Tahrir saying exactly where he was, saying it was the safest place to be in all of Egypt. And he was bringing you the voices of, the networks were showing you that bird's eye view, which was very impressive. But there was Sharif on the ground, and he was with Hani Massoud, our video producer, who is also Egyptian-American. And Hani leaps tall buildings in a single bound. And he was filming Sharif's interviews, and Sharif was interviewing Adef Suef, the great Egyptian writer who wrote Map of Love, and Nawal Saadawi, the 79-year-old former presidential candidate, author, psychiatrist, imprisoned under Sadat, exiled under Mubarak. She was holding salons for young people before Tahrir when they were so dispirited and disillusioned and saying, we will win, she would say, we will win. And Sharif was interviewing the young high school student who is publishing a broadsheet, Voices of Tahrir, in the shadow of the state media building that had spewed lies for so long. And Hani would video these interviews, and then he would, well, jump over burning barricades. He would get around the camels that were brought in to trounce the protesters, and he would make his way to Sharif's family's house, and he would put together these 20, 25-minute reports of these interviews. And because the satellites were down, because now we can use them too, but because they were down, he would then send these reports through the internet, and we would broadcast them on Democracy Now! The next day. And soon Sharif and Tahrir was being interviewed by all of the networks, by NBC, CNBC, MSNBC, CNN. We call that trickle-up journalism. And then Egypt, I think the Arab Spring partly inspired Wisconsin, the largest uprising Wisconsin's ever seen. Okay, so did Governor Scott Walker inspire the Wisconsin uprising. But, I mean, Democracy Now!, of course, flew directly to Madison because this is a huge grassroots movement. I mean, it was a cross-section of Wisconsin society. When they took over the state capitol building, I mean, I went in there and I saw some of the biggest guys I had ever seen, the Oshkosh prison guards. And I went up to them and said, who did you vote for? And they said, Governor Walker, of course. So I said, so what are you doing here? And they said, protesting Governor Walker, of course. And I said, but why? And they said, he didn't say he was going to go after our wives, the teachers. He didn't say he was going to go after our neighbors, our community. And then outside, freezing cold, 150 people marching, I go up to this older gentleman with white hair and glasses. He's sloshing through the snow with a sign that says, IRS auditors against Walker. And you knew the governor was in trouble. I mean, I never saw such scenes as, you know, Governor Walker assured the police and the firefighters he would not go after them. I mean, he was... What he was trying to do is eviscerate the collective bargaining unit, the collective bargaining rights of public unions. But he told the police and firefighters, not them, just the nurses and the teachers. But the firefighters and the police said, uh-uh, if you're going after them, you're going after us. And so the scenes in front of The scenes in front of the governor's office, amazing. You'd have the young people with dreads who were drumming outside the governor's office, and you'd have the police next to them rocking out to the music. And then let's move forward to August and September, right? The thousands of people went to Washington to form a ring around the Rose Garden to get President Obama to stop the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline from Alberta to the Gulf of Mexico. And 1,200 people got arrested there, and then people headed up to New York. And, well, September 17th, 2011, thousands of people marched to Wall Street and ended up at Zuccotti Park and formed the first Occupy Wall Street encampment and made history. I remember how the corporate media dealt with it. Nothing. Not the first day, not the second day, not the third day. They just didn't mention it. I mean, here they were, under their noses, right? This is the media metropolis of the world, New York, and they're down the street. And these media personalities just don't talk about it. And then the second week, well, they have to say something, and so they start ridiculing them. I remember watching one of the morning talk shows, and they're saying, who are these people? They can't get it together enough. I mean, everyone's got a different sign. They can't even get it together enough to choose a spokesperson, because if they did, we'd have him right here in the studio. But what do they want? What are their demands? And I thought, really? Any Madison Avenue PR exec would drool to be the one credited with perhaps the most famous slogan in U.S. history. We are the 99%. Whether you agree or disagree with it, this is a slogan, a motto that resonated across this country. The word occupy occupied the language, not only the English language, but languages all over the country. And then I want to talk about the pizza. You know, Egyptians were calling into the local New York pizzerias, ordering pizzas to be sent to Zuccotti Park to feed the occupiers. Wisconsinites were calling into the local pizzerias, feed the occupiers. So these pizzas were flying into Zuccotti Park at such a rate. And, of course, the occupiers called them occupies. And there was so much pizza coming in. They would hold these huge buffets. Hundreds of people would line up. And, you know, this was right next to Wall Street. I saw bankers online. They heard there was a free lunch. So, and then they were conservationists, the occupiers, if nothing else. They would use every aspect of these pizza. They would eat the pies. And then they would use the lids of the pizza boxes to make signs. I remember this freak snowstorm in October, right? And everyone goes under the tarps. They clear up all the signs because they don't want them to get soggy, but they have one sign out, hell snow, we won't go. They had other signs too, like, I'll believe a corporation is a person when Texas executes one. And now I want to talk about the other signs that people carried into Zuccotti Park on September 17th. There were many of these. They said, too much doubt, and I am Troy Davis. I am Troy Davis. See, Occupy was September 17th. 4 days later, Troy Anthony Davis was scheduled to die. So Democracy Now! Flew from Zuccotti Park to Jackson, Georgia, where the death row prison was. And I want to read an excerpt from the column Dennis Moynihan and I wrote, Troy Davis and the Machinery of Death. Yes, on September 21st at 7 p.m., Troy Anthony Davis was scheduled to die. We were reporting live from outside Georgia's death row in Jackson, awaiting news about whether the Supreme Court would spare his life. Davis was sentenced to death for the murder of off-duty Savannah police officer Mark McPhail in 1989. 7 of the 9 non-police witnesses in his trial later recanted or changed their testimony, some alleging police intimidation for their original false statements. No physical evidence linked Davis to the shooting. Davis was one of more than 3,200 prisoners on death row in the United States. He'd faced 3 prior execution dates. With each one, global awareness grew and all sorts of groups took up his cause. Amnesty International, the NAACP, The Pope called for clemency for Troy Anthony Davis. So did William Sessions, the former FBI director. So did Bob Barr, the former Republican Georgia Congress member. So did Alan Ault, the former death row prison warden of this prison, and five other prison wardens, like Jeannie Woodard, who we interviewed yesterday morning at Stanford University. She was the former prison warden of San Quentin. She joined with other prison wardens. And these other prison wardens were not against the death penalty, but they were against it in the case of Troy Davis. They said, as Jeannie Woodard said yesterday morning, too much doubt. And this is particularly significant as California weighs on November 6th whether to overturn the death penalty in California, which will have such repercussions for the rest of the country. But we race to Jackson, Georgia. If we could have been in the execution chamber broadcasting, we would have been. I really do believe we must show the images. Most people in this country do not understand how alone we are in the United States, the only industrialized country in the only country in the industrialized world to execute the death penalty. We should show exactly what the execution protocol is. Show the prisoner strapped down on a cross like gurney with the needle injected in his arm, and at the last minute, the window that overlooks his gurney opens, and you see the curtains are pulled back, the family of the murder victim, and the prisoner's guests, if they're allowed, and the reporters there. We should show this whole scene. Well, we couldn't be there, but we were on the prison grounds. The Department of Corrections immediately said, when we were going over to the protest pen that they erected on the grounds, they would allow 150 protesters there. But of course, there were more than 1,000, so they were held across the street. The students from the historically black colleges, Morehouse and Spelman, holding candles. And on the grounds were the human rights leaders, heads of Amnesty International, NAACP, the family of Troy Anthony Davis, people from around the world. Now, they said that we as journalists could not go near them. We would have to stay on the outskirts of the property. And I looked over at the elite journalists and I thought, why aren't they pushing back? I mean, if we're going to broadcast for hours, I'm not going to talk the whole time. I mean, it's our job as journalists to go to where the silence is, to interview the people who have come here to make a statement. These journalists, though, I guess the reason they weren't fighting back, I mean, if they're going to be broadcasting for 30 or 60 seconds, it's not that hard to fill the time. But then our broadcast truck pulled up, you know, like one that Fox would get the next day, CNN would get the day before, and we needed a broadcast truck. How many of you watched our broadcast that night from death row or the next morning when we play the highlights? I encourage everyone to go to democracynow.org. It was astounding to be this witness to history that night. If journalism is the first draft of history, it's critical that we as journalists be in these places to document what happens in all of our names. So when the broadcast truck pulled up, I saw the power of big. I mean, the guys in the truck were bigger than the Oshkosh prison guards. They pulled down the window and they said to me, "Where do you want the truck?" And I'm looking nervously at the prison guards. I said, "Well, they're saying," they said, "Miss Goodman, you're paying for the truck. Where do you want it?" I said, "Well, I was actually thinking about that protest pen." And they barreled this truck over to the pen. This is what they do for CNN and they do for Fox. And then they drive over to the truck and then they say, "Where do you want to stand?" I said, "Well, I was thinking of just standing against the rope so I could interview the people." They hand me the microphone. They say, "Start broadcasting." And so we did. Now, we had been given a press packet by the Department of Corrections. The press packet was thin. It described how Troy Anthony Davis would spend the last day of his life. It said his schedule was 9 to 3, he could see family. Then at 3 o'clock, they would have to clear out for a routine physical. Routine physical? You know what happened to a Texas man a while ago. He was on death row. He attempted suicide. They raced him to the hospital. They got him better. And then they executed him. And then another of the pages in this press packet described what Troy Anthony Davis would have for dinner. He already turned down the special meal. The press kit described the standard tray Davis would be offered in detail. It said he would get grilled cheeseburgers, oven brown potatoes, baked beans, coleslaw, cookies, and a grape beverage. Then there was the next page, which listed the lethal cocktail that would follow. It was like when you go to your eye doctor's office, big letters, four lines to see, you know, what you can read and see. The first line said pentobarbital. The next line, pancuronium bromide, potassium chloride, and Ativan, in parentheses, a sedative. The pentobarbital anesthetizes, the pancuronium bromide paralyzes, the potassium chloride stops the heart. The only two things Davis had a say over, whether he take the sedative or the Last Supper, he refused. By 7 p.m., the U.S. Supreme Court was reportedly reviewing Davis's plea for a stay. The case was referred to Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. Thomas hails from Pinpoint, Georgia, a community founded by freed slaves that's near Savannah, where Davis had lived. The eyewitness, the Supreme Court, denied the plea. Davis's execution began at 10:53 p.m. A prison spokesperson delivered the news to the reporters outside. Time of death, 11:08 p.m. The eyewitnesses to the execution stepped out. According to an Associated Press reporter who was there, these were Troy Davis's final words. He said, "I'd like to address the McPhail family, let you know I'm not the one who killed your son, your father, your brother. I am innocent. I did not have a gun. All I can ask is you look deeper into this case so that you really can finally see the truth. I ask my family and friends to continue to fight this fight." And then he turned to his executioners and said, "For those about to take my life, God have mercy on your souls and God bless your souls." The state of Georgia took Davis's body to Atlanta for an autopsy, charging his family for the transportation. On Troy Davis's death certificate, the cause of death is listed simply as homicide. As we stood on the grounds of the prison just after Troy Davis was executed, the Department of Corrections threatened to pull the plug on our broadcast. The show was over. And I was reminded of what Gandhi reportedly answered when asked what he thought of Western civilization. He responded, "I think it would be a good idea." One of the movements that fueled the Occupy movement, and such a significant movement it was. And now I want to talk for a moment about something that I've been deeply concerned about in these years, and that is the militarization of police and the crackdown on dissent in this country. We have something in this country called the Posse Comitatus Act, and I think most people think it's a good idea. The idea that soldiers shouldn't march through the streets of the United States. But I feel the way that the authorities are getting around this is by militarizing the police. And this is a very serious issue, this crackdown on dissent, because dissent is what will save us. I mean, since 9/11, billions of dollars have been poured into local police departments. They are buying tanks. They are buying drones. I understand that right here in Seattle, there's a controversy around this. The level of surveillance is unprecedented. We have been focusing on a series that the AP, the Associated Press, did this year, for which they won the Pulitzer Prize, on one police department, the New York Police Department, and the level of surveillance they have engaged in over the years, working with the Central Intelligence Agency of the Arab American and Muslim community in the greater New York area. I say greater New York area because the New York police are going beyond the boundaries of New York. They're going into New Jersey. They're going into Connecticut. The Yale University president was so enraged by this, he issued a statement saying, "You have no right to come and surveil our students." In New Jersey, officials said the same thing. One of the ways this case was cracked was a New Jersey landlord discovered all the surveillance equipment in one of his apartments. He got so nervous, he called the police. But it was the police. And, I mean, we had on a CUNY student, City University of New York, Muslim student whose name appeared in the police documents. And his parents didn't want him to come on, didn't want him to do any media. They were afraid. But he said, "No, we're already identified. Our only protection is if I speak out." So he went on Democracy Now! And he talked about how the documents described a camping trip he took one weekend with his friends. All the details of this camping trip, from beginning to end. Obviously, one of the people in the trip was an infiltrator, the think the guy that drove him, one guy they didn't know as well. And yet, you know, young people, it's good not to be in cliques, to be welcoming to people who want to join you. And yet, this is what happened. And this student said that the police documents said these students were so extreme that they prayed 4 times a day. He said, "This infiltrator was so stupid, he didn't know we pray 5 times a day. But what happens when this happens? What happens when communities feel under siege, feel they're targeted? This doesn't increase our national security. In fact, it makes things much more dangerous, because when you're in a targeted community and you're afraid, you see something and you should say something, you're not going to say it to the people who are targeting you. This only decreases our national security. I was invited on one of the networks recently, and a reporter said to me, the interviewer said, "But, you know, 9/11 happened, and we have to be very vigilant." And I said, "That's true, but we have to have a uniform standard of justice." I mean, think about when Timothy McVeigh blew up the Oklahoma City Federal Building, right? He's charged, he's tried, and he was convicted. After he did this and killed more than 160 people, did police departments around the country infiltrate, surveil, and monitor all white Christian communities? Hardly. We have to have a uniform standard of justice. And this kind of targeting only leads to bigotry and stereotyping that ultimately will make us less safe. And on the issue of police violence against protesters, I mean, we saw it so much at Occupy. I mean, some of the largest mass arrests in U.S. history. I mean, the Brooklyn Bridge arrest of more than 700 people. The students at UC Davis who were pepper sprayed, point blank range, protesting budget cuts. Now they've won something like $30,000 apiece. But, you know, to talk about this in Seattle is so significant because, I mean, let's go back to the Battle of Seattle. You know, Democracy Now! Was there. It was when we were first broadcasting on TV as well as radio. And, I mean, the level of violence that was directed at the peaceful protesters, I think there's no one who describes it better than your former police chief, Norm Stamper. I mean, at the time, he tried to stamp out all dissent. Effectively, that's what he tried to do. He met these peaceful protesters, you know, high school students with their teachers, environmentalists, union activists, French farmers, doctors, nurses, who were concerned about the World Trade Organization that was having its meeting here, concerned that this supranational organization could overturn the laws of democratically elected legislatures. Like in California, they're trying to pass, some people are trying to pass the GMO Labeling Act, right, a proposition that would label GMO foods. Just let me use that as an example. So if they pass that, the concern is that a country could file a complaint with the World Trade Organization that says California has now introduced an obstacle, a barrier to trade that's WTO illegal. The idea that this organization unaccountable, largely accountable to corporations, could then overturn the laws that are passed by the population of a state? This is what concerned people. This is just an example. Now, Norm Stamper, who was really forced out because of what he did, has become one of the most eloquent spokespeople against the militarization of police, saying he made a tragic error at that time. He had the police separate from the protesters, from these peaceful protesters, meeting them with a level of force. I mean, within the first 2 days, they were going out to other states to find more, pepper spray and gas, whatever it was that they were using, because they'd used it all up. The mass arrests that were taking place, hitting the protesters with these rubber bullets. At first, Seattle was denying they were using rubber bullets. This is really when IndyMedia.org came into its own, because they were showing the photographs of the rubber bullets. CNN.com was repeating the words of power saying they weren't doing it, and IndyMedia.org was getting more hits than CNN.com just showing the evidence on the ground. We had Chief Stamper on Democracy Now! Along with a police spokesperson for the Police Foundation. This was not so long ago, who had organized a call of 18 police chiefs on how they would deal with the Occupy encampments. And he said to Chief Stamper, I am so honored to be on Democracy Now! With you. We see you as the model. And Chief Stamper said, the model? No. I am not the model, what we did in 1999. We made a tragic mistake. And this is extremely serious for the police to separate themselves like this. I mean, they have not only face shields, they have full body shields. They move in as a wall on these protesters. That's if you're lucky, if they're not using horses and dogs, as so often happens. Now, you know, we had our own experience with the police 4 years ago at Democracy Now! When we were covering the Republican convention in St. Paul, and I'll just briefly describe this. It's not dissimilar from the experience a lot of journalists and others have had. But it was the first day of the Republican convention. We come from Denver. There were mass peace protests there. We flew into St. Paul. It was Labor Day, September 1st, 2008. The convention was going to begin in the afternoon. It was the Palin-McCain convention. And 10,000 people marched on this beautiful blue sky day for peace. It was like 10 in the morning. They marched from St. Paul City Hall to the Excel Center. We were covering the protest, interviewing people. It was led by soldiers, some in full military regalia, which is very brave. I mean, they faced consequences for this. Some were refusing to go to Iraq or Afghanistan. Some were still going but felt it was wrong. Some were had never gone, had said no. And there were thousands of civilians. And then I went to the convention floor to interview delegates as the convention began, delegates from the hottest state, from Alaska. And my colleague, Sharif Abdokadous, Nicole Salazar, a multimedia producer, went to the TV station to start preparing the show for the next day. And I get a call on the floor of the convention from Mike Burke, our senior producer. He says, come quickly to 7th and Jackson. Nicole and Sharif have been bloodied and beaten by the police and arrested. I said, what are you talking about? They're in the TV studio. That's where we had just left them. He said, get to 7th and Jackson fast. So we race off the floor of the convention. I was working with Rick Rouse, great filmmaker who did Fourth World War and Zapatista and other films with Jackie Suin. And by the way, speaking of films, everyone should see the new film based on my colleague, Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez's groundbreaking book, Harvest of Empire. The film, I hope you could screen it here at Town Hall or at a film festival here, is called Harvest of Empire, The Untold Story of Latinos in America. Is very important to see. It casts an entirely different, tells a different story about why immigrants come to this country, particularly focusing on U.S. military intervention as well as U.S. economic policies in Central America. It opened in New York and Los Angeles to sold-out audiences, held over, now opening in San Francisco and Washington. Get that film, Harvest of Empire, to Seattle. So Rick and I raced off the floor of the convention. We went to 7th and Jackson, and there we see riot police have fully contained the area. I've got the credentials that allow me to interview presidents and vice presidents, you know, the top security credentials. And the police see that. These are the credentials they recognize. And I came up to him, I said, I've just come from the convention. Two of our reporters are inside. They have the same credentials I do. Can I speak to your commanding officer? We need to have them released. It wasn't seconds before they ripped me through the police line, twisted my arms back, slapped the handcuffs on, pushed me up against a car, on against the wall, and onto the ground, charging me with a misdemeanor, interfering with a peace officer. If only there was a peace officer in the vicinity. And from my vantage point on the ground, I'm still desperately looking for Sharif and Nicole. I see Sharif across the parking lot. His hands are behind his back. I demand to be brought to him. Finally, the police do. We're standing next to each other. His arm is bleeding. He's handcuffed, too. We've both got our credentials around our neck, and the Secret Service come and rip those credentials from around our necks. Then I'm brought into the police van, and that's where Nicole is. Her face is bleeding. She has credentials on. I said, Nicole, what happened? And I said, I thought you were in the TV station. And she said, we were. But we heard this commotion outside, so we grabbed camera and microphone. We raced downstairs. And we saw some protesters, but we mainly saw police. She said, I was in the parking lot against the parked cars, and all of a sudden this phalanx of police came at me, this formation of police, of riot police. She said she was filming, and she was holding up her press pass. She didn't plan to film her own violent arrest. The police are shouting, on your face, whatever that means. And she is shouting back, press, press. And she didn't know what hit her. They hit her from behind and in front of her, and they took her down on her face. They had knee or boot in her back. They were pulling on her legs, so they're dragging her face through the gravel. The first thing to go down is her camera. It tumbles down, and they pull the battery out of her camera, if you're wondering what it was they wanted to stop happening. Now, Sharif is a very cool guy, right? 2 years later, he'd cover the Egyptian revolution, and he doesn't get arrested in Mubarak's Egypt, but he gets arrested in the streets of the United States covering what's supposed to be a celebration of democracy, the Republican convention. So he goes up to the rioting police, and he says, calm down. And they take him, they throw him up against the wall, they kick him twice in the chest, and they take him down. And Nicole and Sharif face PC felony riot charges. That's probable cause felony riot. So I am taken to the police garage where they've erected cages to put the protesters in. And Sharif and Nicole are taken to jail. The video of our arrests went viral. Well, most watch YouTube video of the first 2 days of the convention. And this shows how activism can truly be liberating, because within a few hours, we were liberated. I mean, the thousands of people who wrote in, called in, faxed in, tweeted in the Twin City authorities, it freed me and then Nicole and Sharif. Sharif was in jail with an AP photographer in the same cell. Sharif was released before the AP photographer. There were more than 40 reporters who were arrested that week. So then I'm taken back to the convention center. It's late at night. The convention's over for the first night because the networks want to interview me, like, what happened? And I'm in the NBC skybox. And after the interview, an NBC reporter comes up to me and he says, why didn't I get arrested? And I said, I don't know. Were you out there covering the protests? He said, no. So I said, well, I don't get arrested in the skybox either. You know, as Woody Allen says, 90% of life is just showing up. You got to get out there. And, you know, it's our job to interview people on the convention floor, to try to get into the corporate suites to see who's funding these conventions, but also to get out into the streets where the uninvited guests are, sometimes thousands of them. You know, democracy is a messy thing, and it's our job to capture it all. And we shouldn't have to get a record when we put things on the record. So the next day, Police Chief Harrington, the police chief of St. Paul, held a news conference to announce how successful the first day of the police operation had been. And I went to the news conference, and the officer who opened the door of the news conference was my processing officer the night before. And I said to him, you not only have to let me into this news conference, you have to let me out when it's done. So I raised my hand and I asked Chief Harrington, I described what happened to us and said, what have you instructed your officers to do? And how do you expect us to operate in this environment? And he said we could embed with the mobile field force. Embed with the police mobile field force. in bed. I mean, the next day I saw a Fox reporter with his Fox baseball cap in the middle of this moving police organism going down the streets of St. Paul in bed, like reporters in bed in the front lines of troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. I'm not saying those reporters who do that aren't brave, but I think the embedding process has brought the media to an all-time low. The Pentagon calls it a spectacular success, which is why it's a total failure. I mean, as my colleague, journalist Alan Nairn, says, what are you going to get when you are covering the war from the trigger end of the gun? You are sleeping with the troops. You're eating with the troops. Your life is in their hands. How do you expect you're going to cover it? If you're going to do that, you have to embed with Iraqi hospitals and Afghan communities in the peace movement around the world to understand the full effects of war. And the problem isn't only embedding with soldiers. It's embedding with the establishment in Washington. I mean, my brother David and I wrote a book called Exception to the Rulers. And that should be the motto of all the media. We should be the exception to the rulers. And the second book we wrote was called Static. And the reason we call it that is that's what the media should give us, the dictionary definition of static: criticism, opposition, unwanted interference. We need a media that covers power, not covers for power. We need a media that is the fourth estate, not for the state. And we need a media that covers the movements that create static and make history. So, we sued the Twin City authorities and the Secret Service, and this took about 3 years, and we felt it was absolutely critical for none of us to get used to this, to send a message. Last year, a Minneapolis judge called us back to Minneapolis. Sharif flew back from Egypt. Nicole and I came in. And we ultimately settled with the police and the Secret Service. The Secret Service were furious. They wanted to be severed from the case. But we had figured out who it was who was involved in our arrests. And it's very hard to do this in these what are called national special security events. Every level of authority is joined together. But it's critical to figure out who is involved. And who is involved with this overall crackdown of dissent? And so we ultimately got an unprecedented settlement, a six-figure settlement, along with an agreement by the St. Paul police that they would develop a protocol for how to deal with reporters. And when we settled, we wanted to send this message to police. Where would be the largest gathering of police that we could address? So we flew back to New York and held a news conference at Occupy Wall Street. We knew there would be many hundreds of police there. And it's not only about the unlawful arrests of journalists, but the unlawful arrests of people everywhere. This all must be challenged because dissent is what will save us. I just wanted to end with two stories, and I know I've told this before, but this issue of movements is so important right now. As people weigh who to elect to be the most powerful person on earth, the President of the United States, ultimately what matters most is movements and the kinds of demands you make before and after elections. And that's why I wanted to very quickly tell the story of Rosa Parks. And quickly, because you all know the story, but the reason I tell it is because the media gets it wrong every time. You know, Rosa Parks sits down on the bus December 1st, 1955 in Montgomery, Alabama, refuses to get up for a white passenger, and in so doing, she launches the modern-day civil rights movement. A few days later, she goes to court, and the Montgomery Improvement Association holds their meeting to elect a leader that will lead the bus boycott, that will lead to the desegregation of the transportation system, and they elect a young minister who just come into town, Dr. Martin Luther King. Dr. Martin Luther King was, well, Rosa Parks helped to launch Dr. King. And when she died, Democracy Now! Raced to Washington. She was the first African-American woman to lay in state in the Capitol Rotunda. Then her body was brought to Washington Church. Thousands came out. Oprah was inside. Cecily Tyson was inside. They erected these loudspeakers so that people outside could hear what's happening inside. We were interviewing a young woman outside, said, "Why are you here?" She said, "I emailed my professors. I said, I won't be in class today. I'm going to get an education." And I remember CNN that day. They said Rosa Parks was a tired seamstress. She was no troublemaker. No, that's where they got it wrong. Rosa Parks was a first-class troublemaker. She knew exactly what she was doing. She was the secretary of the local NAACP. She worked with E.D. Nixon. He came out of radical labor politics. He was the president. He worked with A. Philip Randolph, who together they had helped organize the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, right? The black train conductors. Some of them had been enslaved themselves and their fathers had been. They were all called George for George Pullman, who owned the trains, which showed you why they needed to be organized. And A. Philip Randolph went on to organize the 1963 March on Washington, the greatest organizer of all time. E.D. Nixon worked with him, and E.D. Nixon worked with Rosa Parks, and they were working to most effectively strategize to change the laws. She trained at Highlander Center, as Dr. King had been there also, black and white together, to change the South, to change this country. You know, Rosa Parks sat down on the bus before and refused to get up, as had other young women. You never know when the magic moment will come. But if you're involved with social change, you will help to build a foundation that will determine the future, that will make history. And to show how brave Rosa Parks was, I mean, the media denigrates activism, but what can be more noble than dedicating your life to making the world a better place? To show Rosa Parks' bravery, just go back a few months before to an incident that deeply affected her. And that was the murder of Emmett Till, the summer of 1955. 14-year-old African-American boy. His mother, Mamie Till, wanted him out of Chicago for the summer, sent him to be with his aunt and uncle and cousins in Money, Mississippi. And he was asleep in their house at night, and a white mob came and ripped him out of bed. They said he wolf-whistled at a white woman. Emmett Till was a stutterer. And his mother, Mamie, taught him, when you stutter, whistle. He ended up in the bottom of the Tallahatchie River. When his body was dredged up, his mother, Mamie Till, did something incredibly courageous. She said she wanted his casket open for the wake and the funeral. Thousands streamed by his casket and saw. And then Jet Magazine and other black publications took photographs of his distended, mutilated head. And they were actually published. And they were seared into the history and consciousness of this country. Mamie Till had something very important to teach the press of today. Show the pictures. Show the images. On this 11th anniversary of the longest war in U.S. history, the war in Afghanistan, could you imagine for just 1 week if we showed the images of war? Above the fold of every surviving newspaper, a photograph and a story about a baby dead on the ground. The top news story of every radio and TV newscast about a soldier dead and dying. On everyone's Facebook wall, every email, every tweet talked about a woman with her legs blown off by cluster bombs or a family killed in a drone attack. For just 1 week, Americans are a compassionate people. They would say, no, war is not the answer to conflict in the 21st century. Democracy Now!